Meningitis, an inflammation of the membranes around the brain and spinal cord, is contagious and potentially fatal. Doctors recommend meningitis vaccinations for young people entering puberty and their teen years. Starting next year, those vaccinations will be required by Illinois law. But what if the vaccine doesn't work? One strain, meningitis B, is resistant to the regular vaccine, so Princeton University has gotten special permission to use a European vaccine that hasn't been cleared yet by the FDA. I'm Jim Meadows. Today on Focus, we'll talk about meningitis, its dangers, and the fight against it with local and federal health officials. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Last week, Princeton University students were invited to be vaccinated against meningitis B to guard against an outbreak that has hit about 8 people on that campus since March. What makes the voluntary vaccinations unusual is that the federal government has cleared the medicine for use even though it has not been formally approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Meningitis, a disease that strikes the membrane around the brain and spinal cord, can be fatal in some of its forms, and it's considered so dangerous that health officials take action even for just a handful of cases. One example of the care taken with meningitis, a new Illinois law taking effect next year, will require all 6th and 12th graders to take the vaccine. We'll talk about meningitis and the efforts to prevent it with two health experts today. With me in the studio is Brandon Moline of the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District. Brandon, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And joining me on the phone for the first half hour is Dr. Tom Clark, head of meningitis prevention and surveillance at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And a quick note, if you have any questions about meningitis, our toll-free number at Focus is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. And we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Now, Tom, just to try to give us some more context, we're talking about a type of meningitis in this Princeton case that the vaccines cleared by the FDA are not effective on. At the risk of oversimplification, why is that?
Well, I guess it's important to point out that when we talk about outbreaks of meningitis, really what we're talking about is meningococcal disease. It's one specific species of bacteria among many that can cause meningitis. But that's the one that causes outbreaks. You know, we even subdivide those bacteria into groups, or we call them serogroups. So you'll hear meningitis B, which is what happened at Princeton. You'll hear meningitis C, meningitis A. We have vaccines that protect against 4 groups of meningitis, A, C, W, Y, and those have been licensed, and they're the ones recommended for use in all adolescents, and they cover 2 of the 3 groups that cause most of the meningococcal disease in the United States, but they don't protect against meningitis B. And so that's been the gap in our ability to protect against meningitis in the United States.
Now, there is a B vaccine. Why hasn't that been cleared by the FDA?
So you can't make a B vaccine the way you make an A vaccine or a C vaccine. It's these bacteria have a sugar capsule around them, almost, I guess, like an M&M. They have a sugar coating that's protective. That's the thing that makes it an A or a C or a B, and that's the thing that you use to make a vaccine. It's also an important part of your immune response if you're infected. B is really closely related to proteins in your own body, so it's thought to not be a good target. And it's taken a different development process to get a universal B vaccine, and so it's just taken time. The vaccines have started to be licensed. There's 2 companies working on them, and one is now licensed in Europe, in Australia, and just recently in Canada. All the data collected have been submitted to FDA, but the company's actually kind of taken the next step to work on a vaccine that would protect against B, C, and Y. They have an ACYW vaccine, and they're working to combine it with their B vaccine so it would protect against five groups of meningitis and the three important ones that cause disease in the U.S.
I'm wondering, you know, this is a term we hear all the time, but maybe there's a technical definition and maybe giving an idea of a threshold of the term outbreak. When you're talking about an outbreak of meningitis, what exactly does it mean? A certain concentration, a certain number of cases?
Yeah, and in this case, we actually have a pretty specific definition of an outbreak. In a university or a school, essentially it's three cases in a three-month period. And we talk in terms of incidence rates or attack rates. And so three cases that add up to an attack rate of 10 per 100,000. Epidemiologists like to standardize things to 100,000 population.
That's a pretty, you know, if you were talking flu and you said you had three cases, would it be an outbreak in that case?
Yeah, so each disease is, an outbreak is defined differently, and some not so clear, don't have so clear definitions for outbreaks, but we do for meningococcal disease, but that just triggers vigilance, careful surveillance for additional cases, and it's important to confirm cases and make sure that the bacteria causing disease match. And if it's a vaccine-preventable serogroup, it triggers considering vaccination, considering whether you think implementing vaccine would prevent additional cases. And so we've always approached outbreaks that way, and now because there is a B vaccine available, we can think in those terms for outbreaks of B meningitis.
I was talking to Brandon Moline with the Public Health District here before we went on air about how many cases there have been over the last few years, and it sounds like the last thing that would qualify as an outbreak of, say, three cases in a certain period of time was some years ago. Would you say that, Brandon?
Yeah, it's been probably a couple of decades since we've had significant person-to-person transmission reaching that threshold of outbreak criteria. We average probably one or two cases here in this university setting, 13 cases overall since 2007. So it's present fairly regularly, but not reaching that outbreak threshold very often.
Now, we haven't seen meningitis B here in Champaign County or in Illinois, have we?
Not to my recollection, no. This is a fairly unique case out there in Princeton with that B being, like he mentioned, not part of the standard vaccine. So that gap, sets you up for introduction of that B serotype into an obviously unvaccinated community.
Tom, there have been about eight cases in the case of Princeton since spring. How severe have these cases been?
Well, so the individual students at Princeton have done quite well, actually, and I think it's fair to say they haven't all escaped the after effects of meningitis, but they've done quite well, and thankfully there have been no fatal cases. But that's due in large measure to the excellent medical care that was received quickly there, but it's also probably due in some measure to luck, because we do know that meningitis is fatal in 10 to 15% of cases, and in 15 to 20% it leaves people with long-term effects. You can have hearing problems or thinking problems, or, we talk commonly about meningitis, but you can actually have just overwhelming bloodstream infection throughout your whole body, and that's why you'll see some people have amputations and multiple surgeries and really bad scarring after they've had meningococcal disease.
And there was the case here in Champaign County at the University of Illinois, a student who was infected with meningitis in 2005 and was able to return to school afterwards, but she did suffer amputations of her feet and hands. Maybe you could talk a little bit, Tom, about what happens in the body due to a meningococcal disease that would force these amputations.
Sure. Well, it really is overwhelming infection throughout the bloodstream. So these bacteria, most of the meningococcal bacteria that exist are quite harmless. They don't cause disease. And in fact, people carry them in their nose and throats sometimes for some period of generally weeks to a few months. And they don't cause you disease, and eventually you'll clear them because you've built up an immunity to them. It's the rare strain that can cause disease, and the first step in that is it gets in your nose and throat, sets up shop, but it actually gains access to your bloodstream. And so the bacteria flow through your body. They'll sometimes land in the protective layer around the brain and spinal cord, causing meningitis, but sometimes they'll just cause overwhelming infection. You get a quite distinct rash that we call a petechial rash. It looks like large blood blisters that can develop really right in front of your eyes. And that's actually infection in the skin and tissues, and you end up with gangrene and tissue damage, often in the extremities, that the only way to treat it is to just surgically remove it.
We are talking about meningitis today on Focus. Guest for this half hour, Dr. Tom Clark with the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Also joining us for the hour is Brandon Moline with the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District. If you have a question for our guests, our phone number is toll-free. It's 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. You can email your question at WILL-talk@illinois.edu, and you can send it to us on Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. Dr. Tom Clark, in the case of Princeton, a vaccine has been cleared which has not gone through the procedures with the FDA for clearance, but it is considered safe and effective as far as, you know, as far as other countries are concerned. What sort of, what sort of judgment calls are made to make these sort of exceptions?
Right. I guess it's important to know that this mechanism does exist for a medicine or a vaccine or a diagnostic test that's not licensed but is needed in an emergency situation, and there's no alternative. So there's no other effective prevention for or treatment for a meningococcal disease outbreak, a B outbreak.
And this will be voluntary. It'll be students only on the Princeton campus, and maybe you could say why only students?
Right. So there's a lot of things that need to happen, though, in order for this mechanism to be invoked. And one of those is that the manufacturer has an open file with FDA, and so the data have been reviewed for years, and FDA and as well as CDC were very comfortable with the effectiveness of the vaccine as demonstrated by your immune response to being vaccinated and to the safety record of the vaccine in the clinical trials. And we've actually gone the extra step to test the individual bacteria that cause disease at Princeton, and we know that the antibodies you get from vaccination kill those bacteria. So that's the goal.
Now, getting this meningitis B vaccine for the Princeton students, I understand, is voluntary. What was the procedure with the standard meningitis vaccine, the one already approved by the FDA? Was it voluntary as well?
Right. So it's important that the context here is that vaccination in the United States is voluntary. It's always up to the individual to choose to be vaccinated or not. We have recommendations for adolescents for the ACWY vaccines and for a booster dose for college-bound students. And so the same approach is taken here. However, the way you stop an outbreak is to vaccinate as many people as possible. So we were really careful to convey the risk of the disease to the students, the benefits of vaccination as best we knew them, and the risks associated with being vaccinated. And I think the goal is to have the students make an informed decision. But vaccination is always voluntary. It's just you still need to get really high coverage. So the onus is on us to get them the best information on which to make a decision.
I'm wondering about the voluntary part because of a new law that will be taking effect here in Illinois, which will require meningitis vaccinations for 6th and 12th graders if they want to go on in school. Is that the case in other states? Is it a stipulation that that the CDC has a view on?
It's actually quite common for schools to for states to have school entry requirements. Mostly, those exist for the childhood vaccines, and states are continuing to implement those for the preteen adolescent vaccines. So now middle school and high school mandates. We certainly know that those help to improve coverage with vaccine recommendations. But thankfully, you know, we're getting upwards of 80% coverage with our meningococcal vaccine recommendation already. So I think those are an important tool for public health, but we also do have quite good coverage. And you know, for that reason, meningococcal disease continues to decline in incidence in the U.S., and we used to see C outbreaks quite commonly, and those have almost gone away, especially in colleges.
Now, that's an interesting trend to take a look at for a moment. Are you saying that in the long term, meningitis has been on the decline in the U.S.?
It really has. 10 or 15 years ago, we saw 10 times more disease than we do now. So last year, we had just around 500 cases. You know, it occurs in all states, in all age groups. We do think of the winter as meningitis season, although it can happen in the summer, certainly. But vaccination has really helped to reduce the occurrence of C and Y meningitis that we vaccinate against.
I'm wondering, because we're looking at a college campus here with Princeton, I'm talking with Brandon Moline, and the cases we're talking about center on a college campus to a large degree with the University of Illinois. It's not a disease. I mean, the genes, the bacteria aren't saying, let's go to a college campus and have fun. But that seems to be a sort of a danger zone for this disease.
Right. And we think about, well, I guess it's important to say, too, that the great majority of cases of meningococcal disease are what we call sporadic. They happen by themselves. You don't really know how the person got it or got sick, but there's no additional cases around them. So it's really rare that outbreaks occur even. About 2% of cases that we see are associated with outbreaks. But overall, we know that between ages 16 and 23, that's a period of increased risk for meningococcal disease, especially for college students that live in residence halls or residential facilities. And it takes, you know, an outbreak, it takes a strain that has a propensity to cause disease and a population that's generally susceptible, like college students are. And it takes close personal contact to kind of sustain spread. So it's not transmitted casually. It's not spread on doorknobs or other surfaces. It really is person-to-person spread. It requires pretty close contact. But we all know that, you know, adolescents associate closely with people their same age, and that's the kind of thing that just tips the balance in favor of meningitis continuing to spread.
And that's why it's cases are otherwise sporadic, because just in regular life in a city or town, you don't have that sort of close contact like you would at a college campus or, say, a boarding school or something like that.
Yeah, right. These residential facilities especially can kind of promote spread continuing. But also, you know, meningitis is a medical emergency. You need to treat it quickly with appropriate antibiotics. It's also a public health emergency because we know the people who are close contacts of somebody who has the disease are themselves at very high risk because they've probably acquired that same strain that can cause disease, and they probably acquired it really recently, which is kind of when you're most likely to get disease. So because of that risk, we give the roommate of a case antibiotics to prevent it, or anybody that lives in a house with a person who has it gets preventive antibiotics. And that really helps to limit the secondary spread and additional cases.
And if I could talk about the vaccines a little bit more, do you get any pushback, and is there any more in recent years about the concept of vaccines or from people who are concerned that the vaccines themselves may pose a hazard?
Well, certainly, you know, we understand that parents and families want to do what's best for their kids, and so they want the best information they can get about vaccination when they make those decisions. And so CDC tries to provide as much information as possible, how to address parents' concerns and from the kinds of questions that we commonly hear. But we know the vaccines are very safe, and there's some, you know, the reactions to vaccines are the ones everybody's going to be familiar with when they've gotten shots, right? It hurts where you got the shot. It causes some pain, sometimes swelling or redness, but that generally gets better in a few days on its own. The rare, serious, prolonged, permanent kind of effects are, I think, what people are really concerned about. And those things are on the scale of 1 in a million occurrences. And so the overwhelming evidence is in support of the benefits of vaccination and the excellent safety record of vaccines.
And meanwhile, once someone does get meningococcal disease, what is the effectiveness of the treatments available?
Well, on the good side, these bacteria are still susceptible to the antibiotics we commonly use. So the things, if you go to the emergency room with a fever and signs of meningitis, the treatment you'll get should cover it, as well as other causes. They're even susceptible to good old-fashioned penicillin. On the downside, even with excellent timely treatment, 10 to 15% of cases are fatal. The infection can just progress so rapidly that you end up with just dysfunction through many systems and organs in your body, and it's just too much, or requires really intensive treatments and life support to pull somebody through. And so it's still a really bad disease.
Okay. Now, are there any strains of meningococcal disease for which there is not an effective vaccine anywhere or an effective treatment once the disease is contracted?
Well, antibiotic resistance is quite rare, so that's good. There are some strains, some serogroups that can cause disease, although they're quite rare, that aren't yet vaccine preventable. But those are not generally ones we see in the United States. So having vaccines in the U.S. that protect against B, C, Y, W would really cover the majority of our disease. You know, understanding that vaccines aren't 100% effective, but that's the disease burden that we have, and that kind of a vaccine would protect against it.
Now, I'm wondering, you said there are dangerous forms of meningitis that are not seen in the United States. College campuses receive students from a lot of countries around the world. Is there any particular precaution for people entering the country with meningitis?
You know, the instances of introduction of strains from other countries or other places is just exceptionally rare. So I think people should know that meningococcal disease happens every day in the United States, though thankfully it's rare. It's really unusual to have sustained transmission, even if we do see importations. And really we haven't seen importations of the types or serogroups of meningitis that we don't have vaccines against. So importation of disease and that causing outbreaks is thankfully not really a public health concern.
Now, I know your time is limited with us, Tom, but I wanted to get another final question in. I understand from news reports I'm seeing that there are other college campuses which have apparently seen cases of meningitis B, I think mostly in California. that are interested also in receiving this vaccine. Is there any process going on now as far as those campuses are concerned?
Well, sure. Of course, we're working with the states and the campuses involved to understand the cases, the patterns of transmission, and working towards making vaccine available if that's needed. But I think one thing that should be reassuring is that we do see clusters of 2, 3, 4 cases, and the great majority of the time we don't see more than that. So using an unlicensed vaccine, there's a precedent certainly and there's a process, but it really is a kind of an exceptional circumstance, and so we'll make a thoughtful consideration about this every time that it happens and use the vaccines as driven by the science.
Okay, so no decisions have been made yet as far as those other campuses which are seeking the vaccine?
We're in the process of making that possible, but no decisions.
Okay. Well, Tom, thanks for joining us on Focus. Dr. Tom Clark is head of meningitis prevention and surveillance with the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Again, thank you, Tom, for being on the show today. And we'll continue our conversation about meningitis with Brandon Moline of the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District in a minute. We're going to take a short break right now. This is Focus on WYLL. We're back on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We are continuing our discussion about meningitis. And our thanks to Dr. Tom. You see, I put down a piece of paper. I forget somebody's name already. Dr. Tom Clark of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But we are here with also Brandon Moline of the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District. Brandon, I understand that a lot of the work you do is with children, but that also gets into the area of infectious diseases.
Yeah, we over at the Public Health District and Maternal and Child Health have the Vaccine for Children program. So we cover vaccination programs for the community from birth to 18 years of age, and work continuously with our Division of Infectious Disease to monitor situations like this and to communicate and provide programs that can mitigate or prevent, you know, outbreaks such as this.
We were talking during the break about how many strains of, I guess, meningococcal disease that could be a real problem.
Yeah, there's 12 that have been identified that circulate, you know, internationally. These five that we've discussed with A, B, C, Y, and W that's a vast majority of the circulating meningococcal that are really a concern when you're talking about meningococcal disease and prevention. So the vaccines that are out there, with obviously the B lacking in what we offer here in the United States, cover a large amount of the disease.
So, and the vaccines out here, do they cover any of the other 7 as well that are not circulating so heavily here?
Well, the licensed vaccines that are available here cover A, C, Y, and W, which are covering, again, a large majority of what's circulating. As you mentioned, B is the difficult one since it mimics a protein in our body pretty closely. So that one's in process. He mentioned Novartis is working on a vaccine that will include B, but there's really no need and really no cost benefit to looking at vaccines for those other serotypes at this point.
Well, again, your questions are welcome. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. Now, we've been talking about these vaccines, and what makes it particularly interesting now is that a state law has been passed and signed by Governor Quinn for the state of Illinois, which will make meningitis vaccines not just a good idea, but the law that will be required for students entering 6th grade and 12th grade if they want to enter school. I assume that will make it effectively not mandatory for, say, homeschoolers and people like people in those situations who aren't entering populations of other kids from a whole variety of different places. But can you talk a little bit about the reasoning behind making it mandatory?
Well, as Dr. Clark mentioned, meningococcal disease is one vaccine-preventable disease that you really don't want to risk your youth and adolescents contracting because it is so severe and deadly. It's been offered as an elective vaccine for some period of time for adolescents, you know, through our clinics and primary care physicians. And a lot of parents, as he mentioned, have taken up that vaccine for their children. It is part of the recommended adolescent schedule. This will pretty much secure that recommendation, as you mentioned, into law for the upcoming seasons. We're still working on the rules as far as the time frame of compliance. Most likely it will be by the October 15th school vaccination and physical deadline for 2014, but we're still waiting on clarification on those rules.
So it could be by the beginning of the next school year, 2014-2015, but maybe not, and that's because simply of getting all the little details of the rules and procedures set down.
Correct. The legislation, it goes into effect January 1. They're not requiring compliance for obviously the school season that's currently underway. So the compliance date is what needs to be set. And to give entities like our health district and larger school districts like Chicago Public School District, for example, that will have lots of kids to vaccinate, give them adequate time to allow the kids to get compliant.
Now, I take it already a fair amount of people at some age or another are getting the vaccinations.
Yes. Yes.
What's the data here in Champaign County?
We usually target with the adolescent health visits. For example, our TDAP requirement that went into effect in the last couple of years for school entry, that tetanus, diphtheria, pertussis vaccination. Anytime anybody was accessing that adolescent vaccine, we had meningococcal available, again, as a voluntary consent for the parents if they wanted to get it at the same time as the other vaccination. So we are getting, you know, he mentioned 80% compliance. We're probably a little bit under that as a community, but we have a substantial amount of kids that have taken that elective vaccine already.
But what ages do they tend to come and get it?
Oh, I apologize. Yeah, 11 to 12, usually that fifth, sixth grade age is usually when they're typically getting those adolescent vaccines. There's lots of recommended vaccines kind of hitting the adolescent schedule at that age. Another one that's commonly out there for discussion is the HPV vaccine. So there's three or four that adolescents are recommending to get. Adolescent health is really being looked at in the public health arena because they are good at transmitting some things infectious. So we're targeting them as we are getting more data about the lifespan of vaccinations and how long they provide protection, and that's kind of where the adolescent schedule is coming from, is some of those data.
Okay. So now the state law will require it both at sixth grade and again at 12th grade, you know, senior year of high school, about the time people would enter college.
Right.
And are kids getting it at those two times right now? Is that the trend or not the case?
Typically not. Anybody that's getting that adolescent scheduled vaccine 11 and 12, depending on where they might continue on their education. If they go into a college or university setting, some colleges like the university are mandating it or strongly recommending it upon entry for freshmen. So there have been instances where they are getting that two-dose schedule based on where they decide to attend university, but that's not a universal requirement for, you know, education at community colleges or smaller colleges. Some universities have elected to require it, but not all.
Now, the idea that the fact that this law will require I don't know if it's a shot or not, but two vaccinations.
It is a shot, yes.
It is a shot. Okay, you're warned. At 6th grade and 12th grade suggests that this may not be the sort of vaccination for life, sort of level of effectiveness.
Yeah, we're kind of learning, and that's what I alluded to, that the vaccination for life concept is getting to be in question a little bit as we get further into the lifespan of vaccinations being around. We're finding that what we thought would be lifetime vaccination is showing waning immunity at varying time frames with different types of vaccines. So usually when you get a two-dose series such as this, the first dose acts as a primer and protects pretty darn well with one dose, but that second dose, you know, 3 to 5 years later is really acting as the booster and really revving up that immune system and getting that full protection that we want to see when going into the at-risk populations such as college dorms and those communities.
We're talking about the ages of adolescents. Are adults just less, you know, and very young children just less susceptible to this disease?
You do see this disease in younger children. It's, as Dr. Clark mentioned, that really risk behavior of certain populations, you know, as you get in small dorm rooms, you know, if you've ever been in a dorm room, you can really cough and hit your dorm mate, you know, with any sort of droplet transmission. That's the time where people are sharing drinks, you know, tobacco products. In the public health industry, we know that they're becoming sexually active at those ages. So they're, you know, sharing saliva in some instances. And that's the route of transmission that meningococcal is really looking for. So those types of behaviors are most prevalent in that adolescent population, and that's where you're getting that risk.
Well, let's go ahead and take a call now. This is Line 4, Rick from Crawford County. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Thank you. From the symptoms expressed by the earlier speaker about outbreaks on the skin, in the early 1870s in this county, there was a, quote, plague of what they called spotted fever. Does your present speaker recognize that as a commonplace name for meningitis at that time?
Well, let's check. Rick, when you say, was that outbreak in Crawford County, your county, or in Champaign County?
Crawford.
In Crawford County. Brandon, is spotted fever the same as meningitis?
That's not something that I'm familiar with in the current vernacular, but what you describe could very well have been a meningitis outbreak. The spotted, as Dr. Clark mentioned, those petechial hemorrhages usually along the limbs with the smaller capillaries is where the bacteria really gets into and does damage and causes that hemorrhaging. There's other things that can cause hemorrhaging such as that, but it very well could have been.
Now, Wikipedia, my quick and not necessarily infallible source for everything, talks about spotted fever as a type of tick-borne disease which presents on the skin. This Mediterranean spotted fever, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, which I've heard of and apparently can be pretty serious.
Sure.
And Queensland tick typhus and Helvetica spotted fever. And meningitis itself, there are different types of meningitis which are spread different ways. Can they be spread by an insect, by a tick?
And that's not something that, it's not really a zoonotic transmission, so you're not going to get it from, it's human-to-human transmission is what we're worried about. So that's not something that would be a concern. As I mentioned, if it was a communicable disease outbreak, it may have been meningitis. Obviously, tick-borne illnesses are not communicable from person to person, so those are coming from the vector itself. So, yeah, there's a variety of things, as I mentioned, that can cause the petechial hemorrhaging or the spotted type of rashes that we see in some things, and some are bacterial and some might be viral. So, yeah, we're specifically focusing on this bacterial meningitis. As you mentioned, there are viral versions and other types of bacteria that can cause meningitis, but we're looking at the Neisseria meningococcal disease version.
Okay. Rick, I want to thank you for the call. This brings in the complicated question of categorization. We had been talking about strains of meningitis, A, B, C, W, and Y, but the source of the meningitis, viral, bacterial. I understand there's a fungal meningitis, and there's just another sort of meningitis which doesn't seem to come from any of those things that people can get.
Yeah, as Dr. Clark mentioned, meningitis is really the term for the inflammation of the meninges surrounding the spinal cord in the brain.
So that's more like the symptom.
It's more the symptom. When you get the stiff neck, you know, that's really the one that you want to look for, being indicative of potential inflammation of those meninges, because that's where you get the meningitis diagnosis. So the source can come from a variety of places. It's the actual inflammation of the meninges that gives you the term meningitis.
Well, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Still time for your questions about meningitis for Brandon Moline of the Champaign County Public Health District. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. We're at will-talk@illinois.edu. You mentioned the stiff neck, and that, Brandon, and that brings up really the question that you would really want to know, which is how would you know if you were coming down with meningococcal disease?
Well, again, it is, Dr. Clark mentioned, it's a really, really rapid onset fever. It sometimes can be difficult to assess as a layperson individually because you may just think you're coming down with the flu. But as he also mentioned, the early intervention is absolutely key in this disease. With the fever, you can get some nausea and vomiting. Flu typically does not come with vomiting. So if it's true influenza, you likely won't be vomiting. So that will be something to look out for. Once the high fever and any sort of stiffness in the neck occurs is what you would really want to be on the outlook for an emergent concern to get into the ER for assessment, because there's a lot of things that can start to present as flu-like symptoms. Meningitis is one that once you wait to see any sort of petechial rash, if you're getting into the, you know, the blood-borne infection, then it's rapidly progressed, and that's a little bit of a late start to start getting intervention. So those are the things you want to look for as early as possible. If you're concerned about it, you know, seek treatment sooner rather than later, because this is a disease that can progress from, you know, flu-like symptoms to fatalities within a short period of time.
Now, this is a disease, you know, it does happen very rarely as far as we can tell, but it sounds like as a public health official, you would rather have a few false alarms brought in rather than cases that were diagnosed too late.
Sure. And that type of education and those types of recommendations would obviously ramp up with a local case. You always want to be aware of the risk factors and the symptoms of meningitis. You know, we don't want a rash of flu-like symptoms heading to the ER. But those are the things that you would want to differentiate before you do seek treatment you know, speaking to your primary care physician, you know, if you have concerns about your illness, and then if you do have any significant concerns about, you know, your neck getting stiff or things of that nature, you know, seek treatment. That's not something you want to sleep on and see how you feel in the morning if this is truly what might be the cause of the illness.
So it sounds like you mentioned the stiff neck. You mentioned vomiting on top of flu-like symptoms as being a couple of things that should give you a real pause for concern and the need for a quick response.
Right. Yeah, and that's the one thing that the misnomer of stomach flu with influenza, you know, is something that we're always combating. Because true influenza, you feel like you got hit by a truck with the, you know, the fever and the aches and not really feeling like you can do much of anything. But very rarely does that come with the vomiting. So, you know, quick acute spike in your fever. You may get some body aches and some joint aches, but if you get vomiting and the stiff neck, that would be something that would be above and beyond typical influenza.
Okay. The vaccine for meningitis, the one that we have that is FDA approved, are supplies pretty good generally?
Yeah, that's not a vaccine that we have had any shortage issues with since its licensing. We have it available at the public health district. We will have it available for the school compliance clinics that we host over the summer. We will have Vaccine for Children program vaccine, which covers uninsured and Medicaid individuals that will get the vaccine at no cost. There's a small administrative charge for uninsured folks, but we will also have private vaccines. So those that have third-party insurance, you know, through Health Alliance or Blue Cross Blue Shield, will have that available as well.
And the necessity of that vaccine, we're talking about teenagers. Is it something that children or adults actually need?
That's a debate for all vaccinations. You know, you will get into especially these elective vaccines that aren't mandated. You know, is it something that's needed? Usually when a vaccine is licensed, you know, there's always the debate of, you know, pharmacies just putting out more vaccines to make money. There's always a cost-benefit analysis and return on investment. Just to give you an example, one case of meningococcal disease, you know, can run upwards of $45,000 in cost for treatment. If you get any sort of outbreak, that can be a burden on the medical system upwards of $500,000. So, you know, the vaccine itself is about $100. So you can vaccinate a lot of folks to prevent, you know, the fiscal burden of disease, as well as obviously we want to protect from all the medical complications and the disabilities that Dr. Clark mentioned previously.
And in the meantime, besides the vaccine, what are good precautions to take, especially if, you know, you'd want to know if you have a kid in college, and especially a kid in college or some other place where there's been a diagnosis of a case of meningitis?
Sure. There's a lot of personal hygiene things that are recommended at that point. You know, he mentioned it's not going to be the type of thing where you're going to contract from a doorknob because your, you know, roommate sneezed on their hand and used the door. But again, back to the sharing of food, sharing of drinks, you know, sharing of tobacco products, those sorts of things where you will have exchange of saliva is really probably the most prevalent way of transmission in that population. So, you know, keeping to yourself when it comes to food and drink at that age, especially if there's a current outbreak, that would be the recommendations. And then just being, you know, vigilant about your personal health, and we would uptick on surveillance at the public health district to keep track of visits to the emergency room and convenient cares and watch symptoms that are coming in and primary diagnoses there. So we would keep a close eye on any of those symptoms as well.
Is there a cost to the patient or the family for the vaccine?
The vaccine itself, as I mentioned, the Vaccine for Children program, we get the vaccine at no cost from the CDC through the state, so that would not be a cost. The privately insured individuals, most plans are covering that as a preventable disease service. So that usually is a completely billable, you know, service that they can receive at their primary care physician or the public health district.
So at this point, the CUPHD, you're going into schools with the vaccination program, or you're trying to get families to come to you?
We actually usually host a school physical immunization clinics on Saturdays over the summer while kids are out. You usually host four or five of those.
Where are those?
Those are at the public health district, along with family practice doctors from Carl Clinic. Do the physical side and do the physical assessment and physical health piece, and we provide the immunization. So that's a good entry point. Primary care physicians will be a great entry point for this vaccine. So there should be availability in 2014 to get the required vaccine.
Okay, and that's really aiming at the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District also provides public health services for all of Champaign County.
Correct.
Under contract with the Board of Health, so these programs will be available to really all county residents.
Yeah, the vaccination program is not something that we're really bound by any residency restrictions. So, for example, if
somebody comes in from a neighboring county, you're not going to ask them for their ID or something.
No, we would provide that service to anybody that's seeking it at our health district. We do have folks that, you know, work in the community and drive in from other counties, so sometimes access our services, and we would be more than happy to give those vaccinations.
This new law, is this going to affect college students who are coming in from other countries?
College students, again, it goes back to the university requirements. This will not affect college students.
That's because it's for 6th and 12th
grade. It's
graders.
For 6th and 12th grade, so they're looking at the, you know, the public school entities here with those requirements, because there is obviously congregations of young adolescents in those schools. So, yeah, that will be something that will be. But if we get for example, somebody coming in for their senior year internationally, that would be something that they would be required to get for school entry for high school.
Okay, it does sound like that could be a little avenue, a gateway for a little errant meningococcal disease to come in. Although, of course, it comes in sporadically all over the place, apparently.
Yeah, it's a pretty prevalent bacteria. As Dr. Clark mentioned, you know, adolescents are carrying it around in their noses and throats pretty regularly that may or may not turn into actual disease. So it's something like a lot of bacteria are present in our environment. It's not rare to be around. It is rare to actually progress into disease. So that's why prophylaxis campaigns to provide people antibiotics for prevention don't really work, because it's just going to be reintroduced, into the biome of our noses and throats. So vaccination is the best prevention for this specific disease.
And finally, I asked this question for Dr. Tom Clark of the CDC, but you're really seeing more people on a one-to-one basis. Do you get any pushback about vaccines, people who are concerned about the safety, just the concept of vaccines being safe or not?
Yeah, we do on occasion. We're getting less and less of it as the years go on. And the study that caused some of the immediate concern and pushback on vaccines was debunked here in the last year or so. But the benefits and risks of vaccines are pretty irrefutable. The benefits that they confer far outweigh any of the risks of potential side effects, and when there are side effects, they're generally mild. We do have parents on occasion that like to delay, and some don't like to vaccinate altogether, but when they get into these school-aged situations, they're going to be required. The state of Illinois does allow some exemptions, but it's not an easy exemption process.
Well, that's all the time we have on Focus today for this fascinating topic, and a little scary a little bit. Thank you, Brandon Moline of the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District, and also the Dr. Tom Clark of the CDC, who was on earlier. Tomorrow, gift giving, the history of it, why we do it, with Harry Lieberson, a history professor here at the U of I. This is Focus on WILL.